to a lantern, and we are talking about the high status of father in our religion of Islam. Well, now, undoubtedly, the dignity of the father is unique before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to the extent that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, "The father is in the middle of paradise. It is up to you to either keep it or waste it." You know, this means that achieving divine grace depends on the consent of the father. His position and respect are highly recommended in such a way that it cannot be easily overlooked as far as the Islamic lifestyle is concerned. Of course, in today's world, parents are not valued as they should be. But in the school of Islam and in various verses that we read in the Holy Book of Quran, their placement is high. This position is so great that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has introduced himself and Imam Ali alayhi salam to the people as the fathers of his nation, which means that everything that you do is only for the success and progress of this blessed religion, and they wish nothing in return, just like a father sacrifices his life for the betterment of his children. Well, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And talking about the virtues of Imam Ali alayhi salam is Imamul Afin, Imam Ali, the Imam of the Forgivers, those who forgive.
Yes, he was the first Imam. He was the first successor of Rasulullah. But he shares also many other firsts in the history of not only Islam, but also of the world of creation.
Imam Ali ruled with justice and treated all of the people of the society as equals, regardless of their fame or position.
Rasulullah himself told us where he addressed Ali. He says, "Ya Ali," he says, "nobody will ever come to know the true nature or who Allah is except for you and I. And nobody will ever know the true nature of Rasulullah, as the Prophet himself said, except for two, Allah and Ali." And then Rasulullah says that none will ever know you, Ali, except for two individuals, myself being Rasulullah, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
We are, inshallah, loving Imam Ali and Ahlul Bayt and trying to follow their footsteps to expand our world.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
How many more children?
Gaza, October 7th. The sun is coming up. Boats are moving up and down in the cool sea breeze. Seagulls flying over the beach. the law before the storm. Suddenly, a bulldozer breaks the Israeli-built fence around Gaza. No one really knows what is happening. In no time, fighters from Gaza take control of the Beit Hanun crossing. A land, air, and sea attack into the heart of Israeli-occupied territories. Palestinian forces attack military installations and take over various settlements. The Israelis in the Sharon Plain wake up to the blare of sirens. They're caught off guard. Danger is around the corner. They don't expect their holiday to be ruined like that. Israel describes the operation as an unprovoked attack, blaming Hamas for disturbing the peace in the region. In the United States, politicians echo the same narrative. Former U.S. President George W. Bush calls Hamas cold-blooded killers.
This was an unprovoked attack by terrorist people willing to kill innocent people to achieve an objective. And don't be surprised if Israel takes whatever action is necessary to defend herself. And it's going to be ugly for a while. You're dealing with cold-blooded killers.
But is the Palestinian group's operation really an unprovoked attack? And isn't there anything surprising about it?
Let me show you a map of the Middle East.
Just a couple of weeks before Hamas launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had unveiled his future map of the region at the United Nations General Assembly. The map had no place for Palestinians, and Israel still included the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the occupied and illegally annexed Golan Heights of Syria. The little map was in fact the blueprint for the complete elimination of Palestine from the region for the sake of the so-called Greater Israel. Israel's prolonged policy of ignoring Palestinians' rights as a nation is clearly reflected in its illegal settlement projects. Built on usurped territories, these settlements and their cancerous expansion have dashed Palestinians' hopes for establishing their own state and ending their lingering limbo as a nation under occupation. In recent years, the Israeli regime has put settlement expansion at the top of its priorities. In one of the recent cases, Netanyahu passed a controversial resolution in June 2023 and gave a carte blanche to his cabinet to construct more settlements in the occupied West Bank. One month later, the head of the Regional Council for West Bank Settlements, Yossi Dagan, submitted a proposal to Netanyahu to increase the number of Jewish settlers in the northern West Bank from 170,000 to 1 million by 2050. There are already over 700,000 Israeli settlers living in 176 settlements and 186 so-called outposts in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. All of these settlements and outposts and the settlers who live in them are illegal under international law. Since occupying the West Bank and Gaza, Israel has unilaterally declared tens of thousands of hectares of a so-called state land for Israeli settlements. Mushrooming across Palestine, these illegal settlements have made life excruciatingly difficult for Palestinian communities, aggravating their already dire situation. In addition to depriving the families of a home, which is the main asset and source of mental, physical, and economic security, the settlement building and its concomitant evictions of Palestinians frequently result in the loss of livelihoods and expansion of poverty. These settlements always come with the uprooting of Palestinian trees, destruction of their cultivated land, and discriminatory management of water resources in favor of the settlers. To make life even more difficult, restrictions have been imposed on Palestinian movement and access to resources. The Israeli regime has set up checkpoints, barriers, and separation walls that drastically limit the freedom of movement for Palestinians. This has had a profound impact on their daily lives. It affects movement within parts of the occupied Palestinian territories between the West Bank and Gaza, as well as between occupied Palestinian territories and the rest of the world. Since 2007, Gaza has been subjected to a crippling blockade, which has caused immense suffering and a humanitarian crisis. The food supply is also limited by the siege. From 2007 to 2010, Israeli authorities kept a calorie count of Palestinians' nutritional needs to narrowly avoid malnutrition while restricting access to food for the people in Gaza. Today, according to the World Food Program, a significant portion of the population is food insecure. In 2022, 1.84 million people across Palestine, one-third of the population, did not have enough food to eat. Among these people, 1.1 million were considered severely food insecure, 90% of whom lived in Gaza. The Strip also suffers from an energy crisis. The Israeli ban on the entry of fuel into Gaza means that electricity production is severely limited. In 2023, before the Hamas-Israel escalation, Gaza had only 13 hours of electricity a day. The blockade has also taken a toll on the Strip's medical facilities. Hospitals lack basic supplies, equipment, and infrastructure, and are unable to handle severe cases or provide proper care for the chronically ill. The blockade also has crippled the economy, leading to high unemployment rates and widespread poverty. With nearly half of the population out of job, the Gaza Strip has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. Data also indicate that more than 80% of the Gazans live in poverty. The blockade has turned the territory into an open-air prison where the residents have no place to go, no job to do, and no hope to cling to. According to the UNRWA report published in August 2023, for at least the last decade and a half, the socioeconomic situation in Gaza has been in steady decline. Israel's inhumane behavior usually takes even a harsher form. The regime's military operations in Gaza have led to high civilian casualties and widespread infrastructure damage. The destruction of homes, schools, and hospitals has left countless Palestinians dead, displaced, or in desperate need of assistance. Just within the period of a few weeks since October 7th, over 10,000 Palestinians have lost their lives, including over 4,100 children. In fact, in every action the Israeli regime takes, there is one recurring feature: lack of respect for Palestinian lives. From 2008 till September 2023, 6,407 Palestinians were recorded to have been killed by the Israeli regime, more than half through missile attacks. Targeting Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza on October 17th, that killed more than 500 Palestinians, was the very epitome of the regime's brutality. At the same time, Tel Aviv is also accused of using white phosphorus in its military onslaught on Gaza. The banned substance puts civilians at risk of serious and long-term injuries. As a weapon, white phosphorus has a significant incendiary effect that can severely burn people and set structures, fields, and other civilian objects in the vicinity on fire. Israel's use of the deadly chemical violates international norms. Prior to October 7th, there were about 5,200 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, kept under dangerous prison conditions. Of this number, nearly 2,000 were condemned to life sentences on trumped-up charges. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to torture, starvation, and thirst, while being prevented from accessing their medicine. Israel is using different legal pretexts to withhold the detainees from different areas. Palestinians from the Gaza Strip who were arrested inside Israel are being held under the Unlawful Combatants Law, which allows authorities to detain Palestinians indefinitely without effective judicial review. The law defines an unlawful combatant as a person who has participated either directly or indirectly in hostile acts against Israel, or is a member of a force perpetrating hostile acts against Israel. On October 13th, Israel amended the law to make it easier to arrest Palestinians on mere suspicion. The unlawful combatant law is the equivalent of the so-called administrative detention in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, which allows Israel to hold Palestinians from those areas indefinitely under secret evidence, practically meaning under no evidence. The number of prisoners has now risen to more than 10,000 people. Since October 7th, Israel has arrested some 4,000 laborers from Gaza and more than 1,000 people in the occupied West Bank. Just a few days before Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, thousands of settlers carried out provocative tours of the mosque complex, following calls by extremist Jewish groups. Since the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967, Tel Aviv has allowed Israeli extremists to intimidate and violate the sanctity of the mosque. Under the so-called status quo agreement, only Muslims are allowed to pray inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Entering the mosque with boots on, beating worshippers, firing bullets and grenades, as well as vandalizing the site, have become common scenes in Al-Aqsa, the third holiest place for Muslims. In just 1 year, between September 2021 and September 2022, nearly 50,000 right-wing Jews raided Al-Aqsa Mosque. Is only part of the systematic Israeli campaign to Judaize Al-Quds. Against such a backdrop, the betrayal of the Palestinian cause by some Arab states in the form of the so-called Abraham Accords in 2022 and rumors that Saudi Arabia was just following suit could be regarded as the last straw. The normalization of ties between major Arab states and the Israeli regime sends shockwaves through the occupied territories. Forgotten by the international community, betrayed by Arab brothers and oppressed by the brutal regime of Israel, Palestinians are left with two hard choices: to give up the homeland altogether or to die for it. There is nothing surprising that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was launched from Gaza. It is an impoverished, congested place inhabited largely by Palestinian refugees expelled from their homes during the Nakba of 1948. Gaza has also been under a debilitating siege for years, which has taken a heavy toll on its people. In fact, what appears to be the largest military response by Palestinians in decades is an inevitable development, an act of resistance and a reaction to the suffering of the nation under a brutal blockade and occupation. It is part of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. This struggle for freedom is, however, an uphill battle. The Israeli regime, in blind rage, has undertaken a new episode of mass killing of civilians. Israel is carpet bombing Gaza. Telecommunications infrastructure has been bombarded, effectively cutting off Palestinians in Gaza from the rest of the world. Tel Aviv has imposed a full blockade on Gaza, with no water, electricity, food, or medicine entering the strip. Meanwhile, the West Bank has been completely blocked. Checkpoints closed all across, paralyzing the whole territory. Israeli soldiers are shooting Palestinians and encouraging settlers to do so as well. Genocide is in the making. Israeli jets will continue to pound Gaza as long as the Gazans' hearts continue to pound for their land. But how many more Palestinians have to get killed? How many more men? How many more women? And how many more children? Life has lost its meaning for the Palestinians, who have been stripped of their homeland. So the only thing they care about is taking back their stolen land, their own land. That's the red line drawn by their blood.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A Palestinian woman who was abducted by Zionist regime forces from a school in the Gaza Strip recalls her harrowing experience in detention. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, sexual abuse, beatings, yelling, deprivation of food, lack of medical care, and psychological torment. This was life in the Zionist regime detention for Amineh Hussein. The Palestinian mother of three was abducted by the Zionist regime forces from her place of refuge in the war-torn Gaza Strip in late December. For over 40 days, she was held in unimaginable conditions. She is one of the hundreds of Palestinian women, girls, men, and elders who have been arbitrarily detained by invading Israeli regime troops throughout the ongoing assault. They are held in incommunicado with the Zionist regime troops, taking them to unknown locations and providing no information about their whereabouts. Hussein was one of the lucky few who made it out. The following account is based on an interview she gave to the Middle East Eye, in which she recalls her harrowing experience in the Zionist regime's detention.
Mm-hmm.
Amina Hussein lived in Gaza City with her two daughters, aged 13 and 12, and her son, aged 6. 4 days after the war started on October 7th, her sister joined them in the house after her home was bombed. For nearly a month, they lived under the horrifying sounds of relentless nearby airstrikes. The city, home to nearly 1 million people before the war, had come under a bombing campaign seen as among the most destructive in recent history, proportionally causing more damage than that of the Allied bombing of Germany in the Second World War. Desperate for a sense of safety, Amina Hussein left with her three children to take shelter at a school in Gaza. But that wasn't enough. Hussein told MEE, "The army kept obsessively calling my mobile phone and asking everyone to leave the school," she said. "I gathered my children and went seeking refuge at a school in the central Gaza Strip in the Nusayrat area, but it was so unbelievably crowded that we couldn't find a place to stand up, let alone sit or sleep. I ended up walking around the schools looking for a safe place for my children until we found a school to stay in at the Al-Buraj refugee camp. I stayed there for the next 8 days. On the 9th day, the school was bombed by the Israeli army, although they knew it was sheltering displaced women, children, and the entire families. Thank God, my children and I survived the bombing. Next, I sought shelter at another school." Displaced multiple times in less than 2 months, Amina Hussein was relieved to finally find a suitable shelter in the central Gaza Strip. But her worst nightmare hadn't started yet. Less than a month after arriving at the latest school, which MEE is not naming to protect the identity of Hussein, the Zionist regime troops arrived. They viciously broke in at 2:30 after midnight, ordering everyone to leave the school. They attacked everyone. The soldiers took the boys out and stripped them naked. They dragged all the men out with their boxers. We stayed like this until 10 in the morning. At around 3 p.m., the soldiers told the women to take their children and leave, ordering them to head south. Speaking through a microphone, they said each woman could take only one bag and her children. "I tried to gather all the food cans I could and take the most necessary things for our survival and leave." As women began to exit the school, some of them were stopped. Amina Hussein was among them. She said, "The soldiers asked for my ID and took me along with 9 other women. I didn't know any of them, as they were from Al-Buraj while I am from Gaza. A masked man pointed at me and the soldier called my name and asked me to enter a tent, claiming there is a doctor there who wishes to speak briefly." To comfort her children, Amina Hussein said she was going to get them food and water from the tent. But when she entered, an Israeli female officer was waiting for her inside. There were no doctors. "Remove everything," the officer said, speaking in Arabic. Undressed, Amina Hussein was searched from head to toe. When she didn't find anything, she asked me to dress up and I thought I was being released. When suddenly I felt the soldier behind me sticking a gun to my back and screaming at me to walk. "Where am I going?" I asked the Zionist regime troop. And he replied by telling me to shut up and continue walking until he put me inside a big van with other women inside. Amina Hussein said, "He handcuffed me, hit me with his weapon, and tried to hand me my ID card. It was dark. I couldn't see anything, and I couldn't catch it. So he hit me with his weapon again and gave it to me." The van then set off for a long drive. Eventually, Amina Hussein was taken to a small room along with the 8 other women abducted with her, as well as 4 more. All 13 were put in a dark small room, which looked like a cage where animals are kept. According to Amina Hussein, she said there were thin mattresses in the cages with some blankets, but no pillows. It was like sleeping on the cold floor. We were kept handcuffed the whole time. The bathrooms were all filthy and we were afraid of getting sick just from using the bathroom. There were no running water. You walk around with a bottle of water that is for drinking and washing. The girls tried to help and support one another. We wanted to pray, but there was no water for pre-prayer ablution, so we used soil instead. For food, they brought a small amount each day, which was barely enough for one person. We barely had any food. It was extremely difficult to manage without food and water, without clothes and blankets. My body was sick and exhausted. I was beaten and violated. I felt I was going to collapse. I was worried sick about my children, wondering if they were safe. If they had food and water, if they were warm and had someone to care for them. The group of women spent 11 days in this facility, during which Amina Hussein was taken for interrogation twice and experienced no less traumatizing. Amina Hussein recalled, "They asked me many questions about my family, my husband, and my siblings. The soldiers kept threatening to hurt my children, shouting at me that if I don't tell the truth, they will torture and kill my kids. They kept asking about my brothers and sisters. One of my brothers is a lawyer, and 2 others are professors, and 1 is a doctor, and 1 barber. They are working people. They have no connection to anything else. They kept insisting that they were activists. And when I asked what they meant, they said I knew the answer. During the interrogations, they tied me to a chair, and a female soldier stood next to me, kicking me and shoving me with her weapon to answer properly. They also asked about my social media accounts, and I told them I only had Facebook. They threatened they would keep watching me on it. After suffering in this undisclosed detention facility for 11 days, Amina Hussein was then moved again, this time to a prison.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So in the previous episode, we were talking about why it's important for a teenager to talk about their feelings. And you gave some very practical tips, because you say that teenagers tend to bottle up. And, you know, when they express themselves, they are able to clear up their mind. And the parents are, you know, they're the best supporters. And because there are times where teenagers can be very aloof and isolating, but if you try and relate to them, try and converse with them, they will open up to you. So this is very necessary. So do you want to say more about this?
Yeah. I must add that, when a teenage tries to now be verbal and express their emotions, they may find some new channels coming up, like common interests between parent and a child. So it's very important to have this conversation of expressing their feelings. And time and again, the parent should also, you know, comment on how they feel.
Yeah.
So that feeling, when it's let out, the parent should know that so-and-so is like with this kind of a built character. The personality is this way, maybe sensitive or maybe a bit like too much easygoing or things like that. So common interests are very important between the parent and child or who you're talking to. The more you express yourself, your feelings, you'll know that even you feel the same way, or even you don't, or maybe you don't feel the same way. So if you feel the same way, that's an ideal situation. If, for example, somebody, mostly we as human beings feel bad when somebody, you know, like ignores us or something like
true,
that. Yeah?
Yeah.
So if, for example, girls are more emotional, so they may face this kind of problem of people being ignoring them in school, or the teacher. That's a very bad situation, but the teacher sometimes ignores the child.
Yeah, that's difficult.
You know, here I am reminded of a very interesting incident that there was a girl in my family, and she was also facing a problem with the teacher. But why? Is because she was super intelligent, but she couldn't shake hands with the teacher.
Yeah.
So when she related that, everybody teased her in class, because of course she was observing the hijab as a young girl of maybe 13-14, but mashallah, she was observing hijab. So in a country where, you know, hijab was not necessary, she didn't shake hands, and the teacher was so, like, he got so temperamental that he threw the paper. And here, when she confided, then there was such a common interest of, you know, this observing the wajibat and religiosity. And it's such a bond formed here when the parent shows that, you know, he's proud. She's yeah. proud of that. So see, the common interests come out in every kind of thing. When we express our feelings, common interests come out. Or, for example, like talking about a person and feeling that why they ignored me. So this interest also, the common interest is here, that maybe the parent also feels the same way. And then they should come up with a solution. That is it like worthwhile to do this? Let's think of a solution. And also asking them for some advice in the process. That would make them feel that, you know, they're important.
Very true. I feel like when a bond is formed between a mother and son or daughter, it's a very beautiful moment, because it doesn't happen too often. You know, they feel like, oh no, this is my own space, you don't have to, you know, get inside. Let's just take a short break and we'll continue shortly.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing about a very important aspect of teenagers, whereby we are trying to say that it's important for a teenager to talk about their feelings. And you mentioned in your last point that, you know, when a teenager starts to open up, that's when they realize that they have things in common with their parents, with their family, and which is so important. It yeah. really opens doors.
That's right. Another factor is that teenagers who talk about their feelings lay the foundation for effective communication in adulthood.
Yeah.
So when they know how to relate themselves so well, when they become adults, they would know also how to relate themselves so well with their own partners Years. And their children.
Mm.
They would be able to do such a good tarbiyat of their child also. You know, so this is healthy emotional well-being. Emotional well-being is very important, that how you relate to your emotions. Do you know how to deal with them? It's very important to know how to deal with your emotions.
True.
If you just bottle up, that's not a good way to deal with them. If you resort to another thing like overeating or, you know, resorting to other things, watching movies or just passing your time with play, it's still at the back of your mind. But if you come out and, solve the problem, then it'll be out of your mind. You'll have solved it and you'll know how to, you'll have a healthy emotional well-being when you're an adult. And you can relate also the same way with your family. So this is like building the blocks, you know, building the foundation to encourage this kind of expression of your emotional feelings from a teenager towards his parents. Like the teenager should confide with the parents so that to have the emotional well-being.
True. I think many times when we talk to other people, they usually bring about their childhood or their teenagehood where they kind of bring out that had a really big impact, or because they did a certain thing at that age, it really helped them in their life at the moment.
Yeah.
Or something really, you know, had a big impact on them. So it's, like you said, it's very true. You know, a lot of things really play a big impact if done correctly or incorrectly
yeah.
during this teenage age.
And then also, you know, it could recur.
Mm-hmm.
So when it recurs, it's always the parent to solve. If the parent is very clever enough to solve and to see what feelings they're going through and to guide and support them, then they would know that the best solution is to go towards the parents.
Mm.
Not that, you know, you probably, you know, like shun them or not lay emphasis on their problem or just feel that you don't have time for them, make them feel that you don't have time for them, take it lightly or, you know, advise them or lecture them, nag them, you know, complain about their attitude. No, it's really giving these all factors importance so that they can know, now I have somebody to turn to.
Yeah.
I know I can trust fully my parent, my mother, my father, whoever it be. But it must be an elder and in the family so that one can know what's going on with the life of your teenage child. Yeah. So as I said, healthy emotional well-being is very important. Another last but not least final point is that, you know, feelings can help identify that if there is anxiety or depression in a person or other mental health issues, you know, that if a person gets timely support, then they will be free from this kind of anxieties and mental and health issues.
True.
You know, sometimes if you are so anxious about something or you bottle up your feelings, you can probably have a very bad stomach pain or a headache or migraine or even depression. Like, you know, sometimes the chemical balance of the brain becomes low out of thinking so much that it reaches the peak.
Yeah.
Then it goes low. And then you have to get antidepressants or other kinds of drugs that are not, you know, good for that. And they say that tears are so important, like crying over when you feel emotional and you feel that, you know, your child wants to cry, give them a shoulder to cry on and tell them it's okay to cry.
Yeah, definitely.
So that they can release those tears, because those tears are so good as a painkiller and emotional painkiller, so that they cannot resort to antidepressants and, you know, drugs to make them sleep and forget and things like that.
True.
So it's very important to...
It really softens the
heart.
Yeah,
exactly.
Opens room to, like,
yeah,
other
to feel better, to feel, you know, that motivation coming back.
Definitely. So let's just take a small break and we're going to continue shortly.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا معطي الخيرات يا معطي.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we had been discussing about why it's important for a teenager to talk about their feelings, and we got some very good points from that. So we have another question. What role does religion of Islam play in shaping the personality of our youth and teenagers?
That's a beautiful question, and it would be a lot of things we could discuss about, but I'll, inshallah, just talk about the main things. And first of all, I want to explain what personality itself means. And personality is a combination of characteristics or qualities that form an individual's distinctive character. What's the distinctive character? For example, a person may have so many characteristics, but they say that he's a sunny personality. Sunny means like the sunshine. Why? Because they're very engaging, very, you know, like full of laughter, full of happiness, like the sun shining. How?
True, yeah.
That's how the sunny personality. Or his personality is like, is a moody personality. Always he will, you know, like, that's the standing out character, the distinctive character among all the things, because of the pattern that goes on and on in life, the way you're brought up, your, you know, your hereditary and your the family that you were brought up in, and the way that you were, you know, like given tarbiyah and everything. So that it means like you come up with that kind of personality. So it refers to the enduring characteristics and behavior that comprises a person's unique adjustment to life. Like, for example, the major traits, the interests, the values that a person has, the self-concept that he believes in himself, the abilities he has, and the emotional patterns he has.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, all these form a personality. So, although I don't want to discuss, but it's interesting here to say that in Arabic, like Quran also talks about shakila.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has a different shakila. It means individuality. Mm-hmm. It makes a person unique from the other. And everyone in life is unique from the other. Nobody can be completely the same. So, basically, it's some Muslim linguistics say that it's the qualities that distinguish one person from the other, or the personality in its broad meaning is the total quality of an individual's behavior. The youth and adolescent and teenage age is undoubtedly a very ripe time to shape this personality. You know, some psychologists also say that at the age of 3, the personality of a child is completely set. But no, here we say that it's the adolescent and the youth age is the ripe time to shape the personality. Inshallah, in our next program, we'll go on more about that.
Inshallah, thank you very much. And thank you so much for your valuable time, and we hope to see you in the next episode. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Saint of the soil, from the blood and the ashes, it speaks with me the sound of the rain, from the battle and the victory.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.